That's virtuosa trombonist Melba Liston with Pow. That's from her album of 1958 titled Melba Liston and Her Bones. Her bones refers to her sidemen on trombones, including Frank Rehak, Jimmy Cleveland, and Slide Hampton, and featuring Ray Bryant on piano, George Tucker on bass, and Frank Dunlop on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Patrice Lead. It is Wednesday, March the 26th, and two things we'll be looking at today. We'll be talking about the myth and math of Obamacare. We'll get a guided tour. But first, all the news that isn't, really. And by that, I'm referring to what will turn out to be, for you, a pop quiz. Yes, we haven't done one in a while. I just want to make sure that, you know, your skills are still there. You know how to dissect the media. I'm referring, of course, to Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 with 12 crew members and 227 passengers on board that disappeared, literally went off the radar screen en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March the 8th, and hasn't been located since. Prime Minister Najib Razak of Malaysia grimly announced 17 days after a search by a multinational team that the plane likely had crashed into the turbulent waters of the southern Indian Ocean. Well, of course, this is a very sad story. It's a mystery and a tragedy. But the U.S. media just went into a frenzy of ruthless coverage. That's the only way I could describe it, ruthless coverage. That turned out, in my view, it was almost like a game of one-upmanship. The undisputed winner was CNN. It went into single subject marathon coverage mode. And today, as a test of your skills, your media literacy skills, we will dissect this. You're about to hear just a little montage of what it sounded like, just taking little snippets because, of course, it went 24/7 on this one subject of the crash. Here's what it sounded like.
The search area now covers 27,000 nautical miles.
Is it even possible to search an area that large?
It's preposterous.
Show our viewers how easy it is
for a pilot or someone who gets into that cockpit to turn off the transponder.
You would take it and turn this small switch three clicks to the left, and boom, you've turned it off.
You can have an electrical failure, you can have a problem with the antenna and things like that. It looks like it's more likely an intentional thing.
Work on the assumption here. This has been some kind of terror act.
You know, first of all, you ask yourself, if this was a terrorist attack, who's most likely to have that sort of capability?
Chinese satellites spotted three floating objects.
On a day when we deal with the supernatural, I'm just putting it out there that something odd happened to this plane, something beyond our understanding.
There is no logical explanation right now. Right, you can say, oh, it crashed into the ocean, but something just seems, where are the parts? Where are the pieces?
A senior U.S. official told CNN that Malaysian authorities believe they have several pings from the airliner's service data system transmitted to satellites in the 4 to 5 hours after the last transponder signal. Breaking this morning, Reuters, citing unnamed sources, reports the radar data suggests missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 was deliberately flown towards the Andaman Islands.
We've tried to go over the scenarios in any way to make them make sense, yeah. And from your professional point of view, they just don't add up.
It went on like that for days and days and days. And so here's your pop quiz. We're going to do this real fast. 888-874-4888. What is your task today as a person who is extremely media literate? Why did CNN and other media, but we talk about CNN as the winner, the undisputed winner of over coverage of a story, why did CNN and other media get so frenzied about this story that they just zoomed in on this one thing and covered nothing else for days and days and days? And with all these different points of view of experts and so forth, why? Let's see how many reasons, as a person who could analyze things, how many reasons can you give me as to why CNN went into single subject mode for all these days? 888-874-4888. Give me your fast answer, because there is not just one answer, there are several answers here. And we'll take a look at that from your point of view. Let's see how you analyze it. 888-874-4888. Why this absolute, this obsession about this one story? And not that, you know, some stories don't deserve very, very close scrutiny, but why did CNN in particular choose this route of just day after day after day? We had all of these experts telling us about the story and all these different aspects of the story. That did not, in fact, turn out. I'll give you a little bit of music and we'll go. We'll keep moving. We have a taker. Let's see. Dallas, what do you have to say? Sarah?
Oh, greetings to you, Therese.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My take on this, it has to do with network ratings. As we all know, because I don't watch CNN, they have been in very last place. So all of this is their specialty, is the conspiracy theory. Pushing terrorism is what sells big time for them. So every news angle for them that has to do with any overseas action, they have to put a terrorism spin on it, in order for them to generate viewership as well as for network ratings to get them out the slump?
You get a 10. That's an excellent answer. Go to
Thank
the
you.
Head of the class. That's right. Thank you so much.
Network
ratings, we got one. Okay, Alec from New Jersey.
Yeah, hi, Duchy. This is Alec
from
New Jersey. I guess I don't pay that much attention to TV, and I guess in the last 2 weeks or so, that's what I've been seeing on every aspect on cable and all in reference to the story. And what's, of course, besides make us look somewhere else besides what's happening all around as everything's falling apart. That's just a distraction. But my thing of interest is this. With all our technology, with all these satellites and all this stuff that we have and this incredible science and technology, we still can't find anything.
Okay, but what does that have to do with the story and the way that they covered it? You got a very good point.
That's a more important point, that we're making so much crazy about all this technology, and just goes to prove to you that even with all this greatness of technology, we still don't have much technology.
Okay, I will give you an and a half.
Okay.
You're very, very, very close to 10. But you're giving me the irony of it, mm-hmm. But I want to know, tell me about the actual coverage of it.
Oh, again, it's a distraction. Again,
distraction.
It's a distraction from... You know what? It's like it's just natural human nature. You know, we're waiting for disasters, and that's
okay.
What catches our attention, like a car accident or something. We don't want to watch it, but we do, like a train wreck, you know, that you can't stop it, and you know it's going to hit. So you stand there and watch it, and it's just human nature. We're all kind of programmed to see, you know, what could happen. So
all
we're
right,
there.
Alec, you know what you just did? You just moved from 8.5 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good answer. Thank you so much. Okay, 2 for 2. That's great. You're doing very, very well as very literate people, media literate people. You are analyzing the story and telling us why it is that we had this fixation on it. James from Pennsylvania, what do you have to say?
Yeah, hey, Therese.
Hi.
Well, it's real simple. When any media wants to make a big splash and focus that much, obviously they want to make an imprint and do a psychological brainwashing operation on the public. So they want, there's a reason why they focus on something for a long time. And because in the future, they want people to remember a specific event so that when they refer to it again in some kind of another angle, you know,
mm-hmm.
people are going to be hooked and using that neuro-linguistic psychology technique.
Whoa, you went all the way there. Okay, but tell us then, what was it, what did CNN get out of that?
Obviously, they don't have to cover all the more important issues that are going on around the world, and it's obviously it's a distraction, and obviously they're not telling us the truth because we know we can't trust the CIA-run media, corporate-owned, you know. So that's
Lord. James, you're in the neighborhood. I'm going to give you a shot at just crystallizing the thought. You're in the neighborhood. Let's go.
Okay.
Just give it one more shot.
Deeper,
I think
you'll
find it.
I don't know what else to say. That's just my common sense knowledge, and I don't know how much deeper to dig there.
I'll give you a hint that you actually gave me, and that is about this idea of brainwashing, but it has a specific reference to what it was that CNN saw to its advantage to do that, to concentrate on this one story.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, distraction one.
Right. Got
that. I mean, the biggest thing for me is what I mentioned in the first place is for people to remember an event that will trigger some kind of an emotional response, which is obviously fear, whatever.
Right.
You know,
I think so.
This and that, and.
But to remember it, but when they remember it, what will they remember when they remember this?
Oh, obviously they're going to remember that, oh my God, you know, we have to be in apprehensive and fear, and it's kind of like a 9/11 event, one of those shock and awe.
Right, but I'm going for what you gave us an idea about the brainwashing, but what would we remember? What would we associate the story with?
Let's say, trust us, we know what to tell you.
And, okay.
And even though we have all this, like the previous caller said, we have all this amazing technology, and we actually know what's really going on. We're just not going to tell you that. We'll tell you the lies and whatever we want you to believe. But the people are going to remember fear and, confusion and... You know, that's what the media obviously wants people to freeze your control.
And most of all, James, they will remember CNN. That all of this information was brought to you by CNN. Years will go by, and you will still associate this event with CNN. Tragic. An almost historic event, but it was brought to you by CNN. Very good. A valiant, valiant struggle, so I'm going to give you an 8.5.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's great. 888-874-4888. You're perfect. You guys are doing really, really well. What is the reason for concentrating on this story the way CNN did it? What have you to say? We'll take this call, 888-874-4888. don't be shy, because actually we're going to do this, probably continue our pop quiz tomorrow. We would probably do that tomorrow, too, because you know why? This is a very important instruction about the role of media in shaping our reality. And there's some basic fundamental reasons as to why this frenzied kind of coverage, this overwhelming amount of information generated by something that, in fact, nobody has the answers to. Everything we've heard so far is conjecture. Everything we heard so far is from experts who are thinking, well, maybe this happened and maybe that happened, but there is no concrete information. And yet we had day after day after day, 24/7 coverage of something about which we don't have any concrete information. A lot of experts brought in from all over the place. And that was meant also to show off, if you will, the resources of CNN. But we've gotten three fantastic clues so far. From Sarah, we got the idea of network ratings, and this is very important. Why? Because CNN has been losing audience share. It has viewers have just been moving away from it, and we discussed this before when it was about the Dennis Rodman case. So they have decided that they have the technology, they have the personnel, they have the wherewithal to basically, I mean, this was like a military operation, a fantastic display of resources. And so they decided, well, in the situation, we can distinguish ourselves as the unrivaled experts here. at covering this thing. Still not able to tell us what happened. But the illusion of all of these experts and all of this information and people over here reporting, people over there reporting, all kinds of correspondents and aeronautics experts and whatnot, all talking about something about which we know nothing. We know only the basic facts. The plane was en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. It disappeared. And so far, after an intensive search, the most accurate information that we can get as the public looking at this is that the consensus of opinion is the plane fell into the sea. Boom. That's it. But you wouldn't think so. You would think that there's a heck of a lot that they know because of all this coverage. And they are no closer to the truth than we are. We have no idea what happened. We got from Alec that the technology of it, and that's really what spoke to this point of the use of technology, the media technology, to say, look at all the resources that we have. And we're putting it to use. This distinguishes us from the other folks, the other riffraff, who can only probably deal with this story 1 hour a day. We have the capability to deal with this 24/7. And that's what distinguishes CNN from everybody else. We have the resources. We can give you comprehensive information. We don't know what happened, but we can spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, telling you exactly what we don't know. All right? From James, the idea of brainwashing is very important because years would go by, and when this subject is recalled, it will be associated with CNN, and that is called the branding. CNN has affirmed itself, taken this opportunity to reclaim its place in the industry as the great news agency with resources galore. They have all the tech tools. They have the simulation people. They could go into the cockpit and give you an idea of what happened. We still don't know anything, and they still don't know anything, but it looks really impressive. So years would go by, and we will still associate ourselves with, in terms of our memory of this event, with CNN, and within the industry, CNN would have reclaimed its place as the leader of the pack in the way and the technology of covering the news. Well, that's pretty good. Thank you so much. We'll come back to this tomorrow with still more answers to get from this pop quiz. But what I want to talk about now is Obamacare. And this is a very interesting thing that I bumped into, quite accidentally, actually. And it is from Howard Dean, who is the former governor of Vermont, speaking last year in September, as a matter of fact, at St. Anselm's College about the impact of the Affordable Care Act, which we know as Obamacare, and the future of the healthcare industry. What is remarkable about this, and we have to keep in mind that he's also the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2005 to 2009. He is a medical doctor by training. And so he comes to the subject with a particular kind of intelligence, and I know normally he's a character, to say the least, but here is a very cogent analysis of the Obamacare Act. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, I'm sorry. Lord have mercy. But listen to his analysis, and this is before the official rollout, the big rollout. He's telling us some very insightful things about this program now, since it's being executed, and giving us a clear indication of where things are wrong. This is not; these are not the only things wrong with it, but it's interesting that he advances this analysis, especially so as a Democrat. So let's listen to Howard Dean's talk and see how from the inside we get an entirely different perspective of the myth and the math of Obamacare.
That most of the health care plans are built on, and most of the so-called reforms that you hear about are all about what happened, are all about the same model that you use when you buy a car. They don't take into effect the extraordinary differences when you are the consumer of the most expensive health care in the world. You can be a good consumer and make rational, reasonable decisions about whether you ought to go to the doctor or not. And if there's a little financial incentive not to go, I don't think that's bad. If you're older and you have some chronic diseases, that is bad. But if you're young and healthy, HSAs work. But all the stuff that was being suggested in Washington assumes that we work on the same free model, free market economics that every other market works on. It's not true. And so I want you, I start with that because I want you to understand that is, I want you to understand that is the context of everything we're about to say from here on. It's not true. We do buy health insurance well. We can make rational decisions, because we're usually not sick when we buy health insurance, about what our individual budgets are, what our tolerance for risk is. And we can make smart decisions about health insurance, because we're not usually making it when we're an extremist or have some terrible problem that we're so deeply emotionally tied up on. But we don't make good market-based decisions when we're an extremist. And that's when the really, really expensive health care, that's when hospitalization happens, that's when the kinds of things I was talking about before with big operations, that's when very expensive drugs happen, that we don't do a good job consuming. It's not because everybody doesn't have an MD, because we've just shown anecdotally that when you do have an MD, you're even worse at making the decision, because you can't estimate risk, and you're not likely to subject yourself to the risk-reward decisions that you make when you're buying a car. It's a different thing. So I want you to keep that in mind, and now I want to talk about some things in this bill that nobody who voted for it or wrote it had any idea were going to have any kind of effect. But I think there's a possibility that Obamacare actually does transform health care, although nobody had any idea it was going to do this. Neither did Governor Romney, by the way, who was the presage to Obamacare. It is true that, I know the propaganda machines in Washington tell you all this different stuff. It is true that the Heritage Foundation designed the basis of Obamacare, and it is true that the Heritage, this is before Jim DeMint came along, the Heritage Foundation was conservative, but they weren't crazy. And it is true that the Heritage Foundation designed the basis of Mitt Romney's Romney Care in Massachusetts. And it is true that the same consultants from MIT and elsewhere from Massachusetts who put together Romney Care in Massachusetts and made it work were also very much involved in putting together Obamacare. This is a free market solution, supposedly, but as we're going to find out, it may end up being a different kind of free market solution. And this is a private sector solution. No matter what your position is, and mine was not this bill. I didn't support this bill when it was passed. In fact, I actually hoped that Senate would vote it down so they could start all over again. Because we came, by the way, just for the interest's sake, we came within one vote of a public option. We had the votes for it, and Joe Lieberman, of course, once he realized the progressive liked it, had to be against it, and he killed it. One vote. And every night I was talking with Reid and Schumer about what was going on, and it was one vote that caused us the public option. That would have changed everything. But we did get, the decision that was made 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago when this was passed was that we would have universal health insurance in this country, or we would approach it, and we would do it in the private sector. So you can disagree with that decision, and I did. But that's what we passed. So we're going to reform healthcare in the private sector. Has this ever been done? Yes. The Swiss have a private sector health insurance system, and the Dutch have a universal private health insurance system. There has to be a lot of regulation, but it can work. So we've passed that debate. We can have that debate some other time if we want, but we've passed this bill. We got to get it to work. And what should we do? Well, here are the two things in the bill that nobody anticipated. Now, one, I actually think they did anticipate. Nobody wanted to admit it until the McKinsey Corporation exposed everybody. But the first and the really big one is the development of something called the ACO. Now, I'm going to try not to use too much jargon here because I know what that's like, and it's daunting. An ACO is an accountable care organization. It's a prominent feature of the bill. What an ACO does, an accountable care organization, is essentially vertically integrate health care. So you have in one company or one structure, and the state laws are different, so California has to do it a little differently and stuff like that. But in one company, you have the same person who operates on your heart and who cuts your grandmother's toenails in the nursing home, all working for one company or one big contractual organization. Now, why did they put this in the bill? They did it for quality assurance. They wanted electronic medical records, so you wouldn't find somebody who went to Dr. A over here for the liver and Dr. B over here for a broken leg and Dr. C over there for the heart, and none of them talked to each other, so there wasn't a good way to keep track of what was going on. So the thinking in the bill was we'll have these vertically integrated companies, and they'll have electronic medical records, so if the person who does clip your grandmother's toenails in the nursing home nicks her toe and needs to be treated, he can go or she can go and punch up the electronic medical records and find out that you shouldn't use penicillin to treat this infection. That's the kind of stuff they were trying to fix. It was a sensible thing to do. It's quality of care. It's a universality of information. And it was designed to have maximal information about the patient so you could treat the whole patient. But here's the unforeseen consequence. If you're an ACO, and you can offer every kind of care inside a single organization, you don't need an insurance company. And you don't have to charge people fee for service either. The reason that costs go up so much in our system of healthcare and have for 30 or 40 years and still are today, all the Vermont people are so proud that their hospital budgets only went up 3%. What was inflation last year? It's about 1.1, still three times the rate of inflation. I'll grant you 3% looks much better than 9 when I was governor, but that's when the inflation rate was 3.5%. Still going up, three times the rate of inflation. The reason it does is because we get paid to do as much stuff as we possibly can to you, whether it works or not. And if it doesn't work, we do more and get paid for that too. Fee for service drives costs up. Incentives do work. We get paid to do as much stuff as we can. There's actually a cardiologist on staff, a retired cardiologist on staff at the Fletcher, I'm willing to bet at almost every hospital, big hospital in America, who's there to make sure more cardiac catheterizations are done. Not there to study to see if you need more, there to get them done. People used to love the Surgicare centers, because the right wing thought, oh, this is going to drive costs down. Yeah, it drives costs down for gallbladders, which are used to subsidize open heart surgery in the big hospitals. So you drive costs down over here, and they go up in the hospitals, because now you don't have more expensive gallbladder operations subsidizing. This is insane, the system we have. And the more stuff you have that you provide, the more incentive there is to do more. I'll give you a perfect example. This is one of the reasons I came into New Hampshire. It wasn't just the scream. It was I said things like this in Iowa when I was running. So I'm out touring a hospital in Sioux Falls or Sioux City. These are very proud people, and they're just so pleased that they could take this candidate for president who's running for doctor, this doctor who's running for president, right? Around there, and they say, we're going to put a cardiac catheterization lab right here. That is a very lucrative procedure for hospitals. They get paid a lot, and so do the cardiologists for doing this kind of stuff. So they're going to put a cardiac cath in. And the unspoken thing is this is going to be a great revenue center, and it's really going to be good for the hospital, and now we're going to have a lot of thoracic surgery because you can't, one thing leads to the other and so forth. So I'm looking around. These people are great people, and I'm, you know, being polite. And I finally said, well, you have another hospital in this town. It's a pretty good sized town. Oh, yeah, it's one four blocks from here. Do they have a cardiac catheterization lab? Why, yes, they do, and that's one of the reasons we want to have one. Then I said, do you have a CON process in this state? That's called a certificate of need process. It means the government gets to decide whether you can invest in the hospital or not because they know it drives costs up. I said, why, yes, we do. Well, I said, well, if I were the governor of Iowa, I wouldn't let you have a cardiac catheterization lab because you don't need to in this city. Well, if you say those kinds of things, you don't get the vote. So this all contributed to the... But the reason is... that when that cardiac catheterization lab opens, they have to pay for it. And the way they pay for it is to do more cardiac caths. Now, it's not like we're all a bunch of crooks. I don't think there's any more crooked doctors than there are teachers or whatever. I really don't. I mean, there's a certain percentage of people everywhere who cheat. But most of us don't. We're in it for the right reasons. But the incentives are enormous. Here's how it works. It doesn't work that, oh boy, today I just can't wait to do 973 cardiac catheterizations and charge you guys $5,000 apiece for them. There's a few people like that. Most of them are not. Here's how it works. Somebody comes in who's sick, and there's a question. And we do a cardiac cath, and we take it back, and we look at it carefully, and we're not sure about something. We're not quite positive. But maybe if we went back and did another one, we could get the final answer. And you can substitute MRI or CT scan or any expensive procedure you want here. Maybe if we just did one more. And actually, with an MRI, it's easier because the cardiac cath, there's actually some morbidity to it. There's some risk, so you don't want to do that if unless you have a pretty good reason for doing it. But there's no downside to doing it because the hospital makes more money. You make more money. And you convince yourself that you could use the information and it's worth the more money, and it's no skin off the patient's back because the insurance company's paying the bill. That's how healthcare works. That's why that's all these procedures drive up health insurance. And that's why the more ability you have to do procedures, the more the costs go up. Now, what does this have to do with the ACO? If you control all the procedures that somebody could get, and you simply get paid a flat fee for every patient in the system, now you have an incentive not to do procedures. Now you make money essentially by saving money. Let's say you get 10,000, you have 100,000 patients in your catchment area, you get $10,000 apiece. That's your budget for those patients for that year. You don't get a dime more, even if everybody needs a heart transplant. Now, there's some potentials for abuse here. You're going to have to, no matter what system you have in this country, there's some potentials for abuse. But the ACO, look, hospital executives are smart. The reason they're not innovative is because they've been paid for 30 years, three times the rate of inflation, for doing the same thing. But they're not stupid, and they're going to figure this out. And you know how I know they're going to figure this out? Because in Massachusetts, which has had Obamacare for 5 years, Partners, the largest conglomerate of healthcare, and maybe the best in the country, or the world even, has bought an insurance company. And the hospitals that compete with them in the collar around Boston suburbs have been bought by insurance companies. Those guys can now go on the exchanges. They can compete with Anthem and Blue Cross, who don't deliver health care. All they do is aggregate and spread risk. Well, inside an ACO, you determine yourself how you want to spread that risk, and you control the expenditures. So what I'm saying here is an ACO, although it was designed for the quality of care, is now going to be able to co-compete directly with health insurance companies, and they're going to do it 20% cheaper because 20% of a well-run health insurance company, 20% of that money goes to totally non-healthcare expenditures. It goes to billing, it goes to big CEO salaries, and it goes most of all to shareholders. So 20% off the top, an ACO can beat, a well-run ACO ought to be able to beat a health insurance company anytime on the exchange where the competition is. Now, in the bill, it doesn't say an ACO is going to turn into a health insurance entity, or basically an HMO. It doesn't say that, but a smart hospital executive could do that for a flat fee. Now, the first thing you're going to say is, well, geez, didn't we have HMOs and didn't everybody hate them? True. I actually worked for an HMO. I had about a third of my patients when I was first practicing were HMO patients. I'd get $15 a month for the patient, whether they came in or not. It was a great way to practice. I never sent a bill. I never had to worry about collections. I never had to worry to see if the patient came in. I only had to do that when I thought it was medically necessary. Somebody had a problem that I knew was chronic, and I knew exactly what the problem was. I could treat him over the phone, never having to think about, well, gee, how am I going to pay the nurse if I keep doing this? It's not a bad way to practice medicine. What killed HMOs? It wasn't the way it was practiced. It was the health insurance companies when they went to Wall Street. Because HMOs were an up-and-coming thing, and they were a great idea. And, of course, when they're a great idea, somebody's going to make money on it. And they did they took them public, and they went on the stock exchange. And the minute they did that and they became publicly held companies, their boards of directors had two problems. One was the fiduciary responsibility to shareholders, which is to make as much money as they can and make the share price goes up. And the other was the moral responsibility of their patients to make sure they get good care. That wasn't a problem either until the market got saturated. And when the market gets saturated, then you've got to make those numbers every quarter by cutting costs. And they cut costs at the most vulnerable levels, which were patients and primary care physicians. And that's, how many of you ever saw John Q? Nobody under 30, of course. John Q is a fantastic movie. He's Denzel Washington. He's in the 90s or late 1980s. And it was at the height of the HMO movement, and people hated John Q was this guy whose kid got terribly sick, and the HMO was trying to stick it to him, and the kid was dying and all this stuff. And I think he ended up shooting up in an emergency room or something. And when the scene came where he just said, I'm not going to take this anymore, the entire audiences all over the country rose up in a movie theater and gave the screen a standing ovation. It was an incredible phenomenon. It was the end of the HMO movement. But it wasn't because HMO's bad. At Kaiser, HMOs work great. And why do they work great? Because they keep the primary care doctors really happy. And when the primary care doctors are really happy, they tell their patients what kind of great care they're getting. And when the primary care doctors are really unhappy, as they were working for the for-profit, publicly held, Wall Street-traded HMOs in the 1990s, every day their patients were telling them how much the insurance company sucked and wouldn't they be better off getting a different insurance company, because it was the insurance company's fault. They couldn't get XYZ, even though the doctor thought they should. So if you have these ACOs, you have to remember that most hospitals in this country, the vast majority, and the best hospitals in this country are nonprofit. Florida has the worst health care in this country. I have a feeling it has something to do with the fact that it also has the highest penetration of for-profit hospitals in the United States. Why? Because they run up the tab as much as they can when you get sick, because that's how they make their money. For-profit hospitals are different. They still make money. They say it's not profit, but they have to run a positive balance sheet, and they want to always have a capital fund and get new things. But it's not the same as having to tell your shareholders every quarter that your shares price is going up because your earnings just went up a little bit more than Wall Street thought they were. So what was the downfall of the HMO movement was not the way that HMOs practiced medicine. Or didn't, it was, ultimately, but the reason that HMOs practiced the way they did was because people on Wall Street were forcing the cost cutting down at the expense of the patients. So what happens under a nonprofit ACO that takes health care dollars and takes a flat fee and ends fee-for-service medicine? The first thing that happens is that the purchasing decisions are made by the people who actually control the purchasing, which is not the patient, not in the big ticket items. It's the provider. When you go to see somebody, you're really, really sick. If somebody says you need a liver transplant, you probably don't disagree. You probably say, if that's what I need, doc, we'll have to do it. Well, that's somewhere between $250 and $500,000 by the time you get through the years of immunization, drugs, and so forth and so on. There's no consumer input into that. But in an ACO, there's now an incentive. You don't want to have to pay $500,000 if you're an ACO which is taking risk for somebody's liver transplant. How do you put it off? Well, you could just cheat and let the person die. Most likely you'd go out of business and somebody would arrest you for violating all kinds of rules, and you'd certainly lose your license. Or you could do what Kaiser does. You could think, you know, if I take care of this person who has these four risk factors for liver disease when they're 20, I probably won't have to pay for a liver transplant when they're 50. If I take care of this 25-year-old with diabetes and keep their sugar down and teach them how to do this right, they probably won't need dialysis when they get to be 50. If I get people to stop smoking and do exercise and get them on a treadmill or whatever, et cetera, I'll probably keep their blood pressure down and they won't need to take, maybe they won't need to take expensive drugs when they're 50 or 60. All of a sudden, you have now converted our healthcare system from an illness system, which it is today, because we get paid when you get really sick, to a wellness system, because now you make money when you keep your patients well. Isn't that what we've been talking about for years? The way to get stuff done is to change the incentive system. And an ACO that puts in a flat fee, gets rid of fee-for-service medicine, and just charges a flat fee now has a tremendous incentive because they make more money when they keep you healthy. I think that's pretty incredible. And when they decide what procedures to do and what not procedures to, what procedures not to do, that's an internal budgetary matter in the ACO. That is, you may pit the nephrologist against the hematologist against the cardiologist to decide how much money, which who should get what in which department. But I think that's much better than having the cost go up at three times the rate of inflation, and is much better than trying to present the patient with a bewildering array of options, which is a good thing, because I think people should know their options. I think we've come a long way in medicine in kind of opening up what we do and coming out from behind the curtain. But you can't, it's not fair to ask the patients to make that kind of a decision for the same reason we talked about, and is why I told you the story about the cardiac surgery chief. So the ACO does a couple, can potentially do, this is not in the bill, do a couple of things. It can change our system from an illness-based system to a wellness system, and it can give the hospital providers an incentive to compete directly with insurance companies. In other words, get rid of insurance companies, which I actually think would be a great idea and a big improvement, because they actually, oh, they're fun. I mean, think about it this way. Today, if you go to your hospital, they're going to send a big fat bill, and they're going to have 9,000 pages of things that you have no idea whether they happened or not. And the bill's going to be upcoded in the hospital billing department so they can make more money. Then it's going to go over to the insurance company, and it's going to be downcoded, and they're going to have a whole bunch of people who say, ah, they didn't really do that. Let's check. Let's inspect. Oh, we could code this differently. Now, you don't need either one of those rooms of 650 people apiece under a flat rate system, under a pay-by-the-patient system, because you're just going to get what you're going to get. You still need to keep track of what's been done because you've got to do the research on what works and what doesn't. I mean, you can't just sort of say, I know we just do all this stuff. We don't have to worry about it because our pay doesn't depend on it. But now you no longer have all that billing infrastructure on either side. Remember, an ACO actually delivers health care. If they can get actuarial expertise, that is, if they can learn what the right charge is given their population, how old they are, how sick they are, and so forth, and make that guess right, and go on the insurance company, on the exchange to compete with the insurance company, all the insurance company does is aggregate. They take your money, you choose the provider, they pay the bill, and they fight with providers all the time about paying the bill, a fight which they usually lose, and then the cost goes up 25% the next year because they lost their butts the first time because they guessed wrong or they couldn't make the providers do what they wanted because the power was all in the provider's hands. Now I'm going to shift back for a second because I said something about Paul Ryan's plan on Medicare. If you wanted to fix Medicare and control the cost, because Medicare costs are out of control, not because Medicare is a bad program. In fact, Medicare's overhead is about 4% of the dollars that come in. And what number have we been using here for the overhead in the system we have? 20%. So Medicare is actually a very efficient system. But because all healthcare costs are going up much too fast, roughly three times the rate of inflation for 30 years, Medicare is not an exception to that. So Medicare is a huge problem for the federal government. Social Security is not. That's some minor tweaks, and we can fix Social Security. But Medicare is, and we've got to deal with it. Suppose Paul Ryan had said, instead of shifting the risk from the payer, in this case the government, to the patient, on the theory, badly mistaken theory, because these folks have no understanding of how healthcare really works, or human beings really work for that matter, which doesn't surprise me entirely, given the nature of the Republican Party these days. But since they couldn't understand that, they shifted it to the wrong people. You don't shift it to the patients because the patients don't buy health care well. And they don't make rational. We don't make, because I'm not any better. I had my hip replaced a couple of years ago. I was a terrible patient. I know nothing about orthopedics. I was telling the orthopedics nurses how to do this and how to do that. My wife, I thought she was going to kill me if I got out alive. And I would have deserved it. So we don't make good decisions buying healthcare, but we do make good insurance decisions buying health insurance. So if Ryan had shifted the burden of controlling costs and maximizing patient benefit from the payer to the provider by saying, I'm going to make the number up because, again, I don't know what it is, but let's say it's $10,000. For every Medicare recipient gets $10,000, and they can take that $10,000. It's not a voucher. It's 100% payment. That's what they get. It's a global budget. That is, the payer has full budgetary control here, which is fair because that's where the public, that's where the political and the economic intersect. So that you'd get a $10,000 thing, and you could take it to any ACO or anybody in the exchange you wanted. The risk is shifted not to you, but to the provider. The provider doesn't get any more than $10,000. Now, again, you do have to have regulation because people will cheat and they'll underservice people. That's one of the risks. But people cheat in every system. So that's sort of the ACO piece. That's what I think is going to happen. And I think it's going to happen not just because I dreamed it up, but because there are smart people in the healthcare business who are now going to be incentivized. One thing you do have to say about the private sector, in general, there's a lot more creativity and innovation in the private sector than in government. That's a fact. It's not as much as the Republicans say. I think their views of government are antediluvian, but it's not a surprise because the review about everything is antediluvian. But the fact is that there is going to be a lot of innovation, a lot of serious thinking, a lot of recrafting the industry in this private sector model that we now are about to embark upon in a few weeks. And I think this is going to be one of the things that I think is going to be very good, is this transfer out of fee-for-service into per capita payment. Last thing I want to talk about before we get into questions and answers and whatever you want to talk about, and I am happy to take questions about non-healthcare related stuff, although I prefer to do healthcare related stuff first, is something that the McKinsey people came out with a study on, which I thought they were right. The Obama administration was furious with me because I thought they were right, and it was damaging to the Obama people thought it was damaging to them, which is they believe, and I believe this too, is that this bill is going to cause an enormous exodus of people from employer-based health insurance to individual-based health insurance, when people just go on the exchange and buy their own health insurance. And I think that is great. We have got to break the link between employment and health insurance. Medicare has done that. And here's why we have to do it, leaving aside the health care and the political arguments. There's a strong economic argument for this. McCain actually proposed doing this in his ill-fated campaign. By the time he proposed it, of course, the bottom had fallen out of the stock market. It was all about the economy. But it was a smart idea. If you link healthcare to employment, first of all, there are a great many people who are 55 and older or 50 and older who can't change jobs, because if they do, nobody, they'll never get insurance again. A lot of the people who've lost their jobs during this recent recession can't get health insurance. People won't hire them because they don't want to have to be responsible for giving them health care. Everybody in small business is essentially in two businesses. They run their own business, and then they spend hours every week trying to figure out how to deal with the health care system for their employees. Or they don't give their employees health insurance at all, which puts them at a competitive disadvantage. But from a macroeconomic problem, how about this for an idea? This is why Republicans, if they understood anything, would like this idea. We are at a competitive disadvantage, everybody knows, with China and Mexico and Thailand for labor reasons, for labor cost reasons. Our labor costs are higher. We are also at a competitive disadvantage with Canada and Germany and France and the UK. Why? Because when our businesses over a period of time have a fixed cost that goes up at three times the rate of inflation, that means that they are becoming less competitive. And why is that? Because virtually, not the entire, but let's say about 75%, especially of the big companies, they're paying that. The business community is paying about 75% of that. In Canada and Germany and all those other places, The costs are also going up at three times the rate of inflation. They're not much better than we are. They start from a lower base, but they're also going up a lot more than they can afford. But when the cost goes up at three times the rate of inflation in Germany or Canada or France or other Western competitors, that cost is spread across the entire society tax base of everybody, not just the business people, not just flow to the bottom line of the business community. It goes to comes out of everybody because the taxes basically support the system. When it happens here, the cost disproportionately falls on the business community if they're in an employer-based system. So every year, among other reasons that American business might be getting less competitive, it's because the cost of increasing health insurance every single year is disproportionately on our business community, so they have trouble, more and more trouble competing. If you spread the cost of health care across the entire society, which essentially is what the Obama plan ultimately may do, then I would argue that our businesses are going to be more competitive because they won't bear that the same proportion of that cost. Now, getting the cost down is a different matter. We talked about that already. Get rid of fee-for-service medicine. This is something different. Getting the healthcare, getting employers out of the healthcare business. Now, I don't think we should force them out of the healthcare business.
Well, we got enough information there to indicate that when this legislation was being formulated, clearly there were other ideas of how it could work to the benefit of the patient. But clearly there was no interest in entertaining these ideas. They reverted. The bill, in effect, is a reflection of what I call primitive thinking. That's it. No need to discuss really what the bottom line is in terms of the benefits that would accrue to patients. More important is the profit margin of these private insurance agencies, and it is in their interest, primarily in their interest, that this whole thing has been formulated so that it works for them. It generates incredible profits. And patients are just a means of facilitating their wealth. And look, Howard Dean is a Democrat. The president is a Democrat. So there is an availability of information that could have been considered that would have helped the system if the intent was to really make it work. But that's not what they wanted to do. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope that was instructive. It certainly was for me, and I just said, wow, I have to share this. And I'm glad we were able to appreciate a different opinion. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Eutrice Lead on Facebook. See you tomorrow.